Group meeting, Saturday, 6th August, 1983. If you are gifted in any special way to write poetry or compose music or to produce a philosophical system or as a scientist or whatever it is, when does your life in that expressing that particular gift really start? Supposing as a child you are able to write pretty verse. Of course, there have been exceptions, and people have started at 3 and 4 and such things. But ordinarily, does your life as a poet start then, or does it start after you have developed through the years and your skill in writing poetry has come to fruition? I would say that your poetical life really then begins at the culminating point of your training, your development, your growth poetically. So that the poetical life starts not at 3 or 4, but maybe 13 or 14 or 30 or 40 even, for all we know. Now, in the same way, consider when the religious life starts. We may be interested in religion, and we may do a certain amount of study and so forth. In our youth, we may be really keen on it and so forth. We may go through certain training, a certain amount of practice with meditation or with contemplative prayer or whatever it is. But the real religious living starts when our whole being has been transformed into a religious being. And then, inevitably, naturally, one lives religiously. This is something, I suppose, somewhat different from the usual conception of religious living. So I would say that religious living is actually holiness in action. You don't have to wait till you have to wait, so to say, till you have become holy, whole, healthy, in the deep sense of those terms, before religious living actually starts. Now, why do I say it is holiness in action? Action is the climactic point which expresses in fullness that towards which you have worked. It also implies that one is truly conscious of the holy, the sacred. Or I might put it in a different way. That sounds as if the sacred was this, that, or the other particular something. That is not so. I know Krishnamurti says there's nothing sacred excepting the sacred as he has realized it. I would say that the total cosmos is sacred. Everything is sacred. Sacredness is in it. It is for me so to develop, so to awake from within, that I can see the sacredness in anything and in everything. Now, I dare say most people would not agree with that, but I can only say as what I see as being, for me, the truth of the matter. Everything is sacred. And when one is truly conscious of holiness or sacredness, it means that that consciousness inevitably, naturally, and spontaneously will express itself in all our thought and feeling, in our speech and action. The inner consciousness is the root source of all our psychophysical life. That is the root source. We can think certain thoughts. We can make statements, a string of words only, about such things. What I've just said could be just a string of words. But for the reality to be there, one has to be completely and fully conscious of it. Now, this being conscious is not, as we ordinarily say, something which is the opposite of the unconscious. It is being conscious in this way does not mean knowing it in the way in which we know how to cook or how to build a house or all our ordinary skills and techniques. It's not that. It is an awareness which is so complete, so absolute, that it is creative. And it is, of course, constantly creative. You are conscious in that sense when you are physically awake and when you are asleep. So that your total organic life, your psychophysical life, will express that consciousness, will be the instrument through which, through your thoughts and feelings, your speech and deeds, will express that consciousness. I mean conscious in that sense, not in the ordinary sense of the term. Meaning that, oh yes, you are there, so to say, all there. It's not merely being all there. It is actually being all that is there. You are that thing of which you are conscious. So now, religious living is holiness in action. And the action, of course, is the expression through the psychophysical life of thought, feeling, speech, and deed. Now, this implies that there is a process of growing, a process of growing which is somewhat dissimilar to the process of bodily growth. Different from that. An infant is born, and we say, that child, after a time, we say that child is growing steadily and so forth. And it specially means that he's growing in size. He is increasing physically. You see? He's increasing physically. Gradually, he acquires certain skills. particularly language. Language. And so we say, oh, he's growing nicely, he can talk now. He has so many words in his vocabulary and so forth. Now all that is of course growing in the ordinary material psychophysical sense. But the growth in consciousness is not an acquiring. Psychophysically, we acquire material for the body, we acquire all our psychical aspects and so forth. All this is acquired, it is piled up. It becomes the sankharas as such. It's a heap, as Avalokiteshvara said, looking down from the supreme state of consciousness. He said he beheld five heaps. You see, it's a heap. But this growth in consciousness is an awakening. It is not an acquisition. You don't acquire any knowledge, as we call it. You don't acquire any specific faculties, psychic faculties or any other faculties which are dormant within the organism. There are lots of faculties within us which lie dormant all through our lives. Some people have developed them up to a point in certain ways, clairvoyance, clairaudience, ESP and all the rest of that sort of thing, you see. And so they have just developed that. But these can all be acquired. The fruition of consciousness is not acquired. It is a process of awakening. It is a... Here is the difficulty. There are no words in the language. It is a seeing truth. Seeing reality. I prefer to call it, it is a case of being reality. When the seeing has gone to that extent, you might as well say the listening, the hearing, the touching. We use phrases like, you touch transcendence. You reach out to the heights of heaven and so forth. All right, but all those words are so limited to their physical meanings that the brain invariably forms wrong pictures about them. So this culmination of the evolution of consciousness is a culmination in terms of awakening to the reality. The light, as we call it, the light of transcendence is a phrase I've used again and again throughout the years. You awake to that light of transcendence, not as if it was something outside you, but you awake to the fact that you yourself are that light of transcendence. You yourself are that transcendence. Here and now. That is why the Buddha said, use the term Samma Sambodhi, fully self-awakened. Now there are tremendous implications and significances in that sort of statement. This Samma Sambodhi, the fully self-awakened. One of the practical implications is the fact that this psychophysical organism, which goes by our name in the world and is recognized as such, this psychophysical organism is actually the path. There is no path outside the organism. Any path outside the organism is a conditioning according to something external which never brings that particular thing to fulfillment. How, for example, does your own body grow from the time you are born? This mysterious something we call life, it is that life within you yourself, embodied in your body, which enables the body to grow, as we call it. It's like that. So similarly, in fact extraordinarily similarly, where the spiritual life is concerned, that growth, that culmination of the evolution of consciousness is something which comes out of your own being, your own psychophysical being. And you, another consequence is, besides recognizing that that is the path for you, another consequence is the fact that the body itself, and I mean the whole psychophysical organism, which will mean rupa to vinyana, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vinyana, all that is your best teacher. The psychophysical organism has the power, the organism has the power to attend, to direct attention. It is by directing attention intelligently, that is free from the limitations imposed by conditioning and preconceptions and so on, by attending intelligently, you really become that truth. It's this power of attentiveness which is one of our supreme instruments of salvation. This we must bear in mind very carefully, and that all comes from within. One person cannot attend on behalf of another. Each person has to attend for himself. Each person has to see for himself. And when that seeing reaches its supreme fulfillment point, that which is the limited particular self, the psychophysical organism, the perishable thing, no longer imposes any limitations upon you. You become conscious of your entire being. It almost sounds as if you become conscious of every single atom constituting you, whether it be a physical atom or a psychical atom. But something like that happens. And when that happens, the light of transcendence is shining through you all the time. You are enlightened. And then you cast no shadow. This is the important thing to remember. And if one sees that, if one really sees that, one doesn't seek for enlightenment from another. One can obtain help from another in certain ways. Just like a mother and a father and friends and so on, and a nurse and all the rest of it, are helpful to the infant, to the growing infant. So help can be received from outside. But that one mustn't think, therefore, that the help which one receives from outside will be the permanent leaning post for you throughout your journey to enlightenment. No. As soon as possible, you have to stand on your own feet. But stand on your own feet completely free from egoism. You know how a person who physically is naturally strong and so forth, and psychologically is a positive type, as we call it, is, oh, that's all right, don't you bother, I can do it, I know. You see, this I can do it, I know, is the very devil in us, which absolutely opposes our fulfillment, our fruition, I should say. So now, if then we see these things, we can begin to understand that religious living begins at that stage. It is holiness in action. And that holiness in action can take place through that fruition and culmination of the evolution of consciousness, when the light which is hidden and sort of imprisoned within you is disimprisoned. That imprisoned splendor then comes out. You know, you may have noticed how in the Buddhist texts it is written, when somebody seeking wisdom, seeking truth, meets a holy one, he says, "Friend, your faculties are all shining," etc. He uses phrases like that. What's the meaning? And has he got some, has he sort of titivated himself in such a manner that his face is shining? Not at all. But the shining of that perfected holy one is such that the person who has not yet arrived there is impressed by it. A certain impression is created which that person will not deny. She says, "Your faculties are shining. Who is your teacher? What does he teach that he has brought you to this condition?" And the answer of the Buddha was the true and the best answer. "Teacher have I none. I have overcome all evil things. Omniscient am I," he says to Upaka. Now that, as it stands in so many words, is a sort of a statement. If I made it in public here, people would say that fellow is conceited beyond all measure, or his complete crackers, which may be true, of course, in any case. But he says that because he knows precisely what he is talking. And not only that, he knows to whom he is saying it. When an enlightened being meets another being, he knows him inside out. That is to say, the perfected Holy One is omniscient where human nature is concerned. He couldn't possibly solve any differential equations of today. Those old people, they knew nothing of that sort of thing. They couldn't make holograms or all the marvelous magical things that modern science and so on can do. But that has nothing to do with omniscience. This omniscience referred to in the context of religion is this complete, perfect insight into human nature. And how does he get that insight? He has lived, the Holy One has lived the ethical life in fullest measure. And this is the fundamental thing. You look at the Gathas of Zarathustra and the whole of the Zarathustrian teaching. They are based absolutely upon Asha, that is, virtue in the supreme sense, the divine law as they call it. You look at the Buddha's teachings. What is the first thing that he lays down for the disciples? Right conduct in mind, in speech, and in body, in action. So thoughts and feelings, where the mind is concerned, speech and physical action. Let that be perfect. There's no getting away from these things. This is the fundamental basis. Why? The intellect may be able to formulate the stage to be realized, to be achieved, because intellect has that capacity to see ahead of itself. But that is just a formulation in words. And that intellect, when it tries to look into a situation or a person or an event and so forth, will not see the real truth of it. He'll see part of it only. He will see the external shape, the external form, the manner in which it functions, behaves and so forth. And up to a point, he will understand, but he will understand only so far as his own personal limitations allow him to. Beyond that, he won't understand. He won't know. But to understand fully, completely, exactly what the other person, situation, event is in reality, in truth, needs the enlightenment from within. And the enlightenment from within comes, has for its fundamental root, its main root, the living of the pure life. The ethical life, in short. So we have these implications that your own psychophysical organism is your best teacher. Attend, watch it carefully. And this is where the value of watchfulness, of mindfulness comes in. Not mere observation as an external observer of a phenomenon which is outside yourself. You are trying to watch yourself, but in trying to watch yourself, you put yourself outside yourself, and you can't thereby really know yourself. But if you attend to exactly what is happening and become and be clearly aware of the reactions which come out of the brain, then you will begin to know yourself. And you'll begin to know your limitations. Because the reactions of the brain are the result of a conditioned brain. Right from infancy, we are conditioned. We are taught to say and see, this is right, this is good, this is what will be useful to me, which will benefit me, I will become this, I will become that, and it's all self-centered. The brain is a very good computer, yes, excellent computer, but treat it as a computer, not as the vehicle of insight. The brain is the concretest part of mind. When the person is really advancing spiritually, he sees all the limitations which the brain imposes upon him. And therefore, all his judgments, his preconceptions, his assumptions and so forth, they all get cast aside. Because every one of them has no warrant in ultimate truth. Because the ultimate truth is the total reality which is expressed through the total cosmos. Some of that expression is troublesome, harmful, evil, and some of that expression is good, true, beautiful, and so on. And so the brain is limited. So the limitations of the brain are put out, so to say. And you begin to see truth with right sort of attention, watching your brain reactions all the time. You know how the Greeks presented this in their schools. I don't mean the ordinary state schools or anything like that, but in their schools of philosophy and so forth. Gnosi se auton. Know thyself. But profounder than that was the presentation way back in the Rig Veda, long before the Greeks came on the scene. They said, Atmanam Atmana Pashya. Pashya is to see. Really to see. Atmanam, the accusative case. Si, the Atma. The Atma represents the absolute reality, the ultimate reality. Atmana, the instrumental case, by means of the Atma. Now, look at the implications of that. The Atma is presented as the total reality, and its context, therefore, is the infinite, it's the eternal, it's the immortal. And that completely interpenetrates and permeates every single manifestation throughout the cosmos. Every single person, every single thing, every single atom or virus is permeated through and through with that Atma. But although it permeates it, it does not compel it. Because if it compelled it, this particular manifestation couldn't come to its own unique fulfillment and fruition. The rose wouldn't become the perfect rose. The mosquito wouldn't become the perfect mosquito, and so on and so on. Therefore, it never compels. Transcendence never compels. It is there everlastingly, the source of energy, of fruition, of life. And it is our responsibility as human beings to do the right thing in order that that may happen. So, by means of the transcendent embodied within us. Now, when I say embodied, don't think of it as some separate thing having a particular residence in some part of the body. It is the entire body itself. Now, these are strange things, but to me they are the reality, you see. That transcendence by self-constriction becomes all manifestation. All manifestation. Transcendence becomes it. So that the infinite, the eternal, the immortal becomes all that is finite, temporal, and mortal. All that is perfect and wonderful, all that is imperfect and far from wonderful, and so forth. You see? All right, so Atmanam, Atmana, Pasya. That cuts out trying to see reality, to awake to the reality by using anything, any faculty of the perishable psychophysical organism to realize that reality. Get it? It's like that. Now, of course, this looking into yourself is a tremendously difficult task. It's easy enough for me to say these words. And after 80 years, not that I started from the moment I was born, but after 80 years, I do see how very, very difficult it is to maintain that kind of open-minded, free attentiveness, which will, I use the word free in the sense that it does not reject anything which one observes. You see, if you reject something, where will it go? Where can you put it? You can't throw anything out of the cosmos. Have you ever tried? The human race historically has tried it by destroying what it doesn't like. So we have wars, conflicts, cruelties, and so forth, to compel this, that, or the other. Look at the inquisitions and so on. Look at the state of affairs today in Iran and such places. The attempt to compel this, that, and the other. You can't do it. All that happens is that the manifestation part perishes, transcendence remains transcendence. And people say, oh my goodness, then doesn't transcendence care for us? It doesn't care a tuppenny damn for anything. Simply because our concept of caring in that sense doesn't apply to transcendence. The totality, how can it? You see, we had the wonderful presentation in the religions, for instance, in Genesis. Man made in the image of God, in the hermetical, the Hellenized form of the hermetic teachings, Hermes Trismegistus declares, you see, that All Father Mind made man like himself, you see, and fell in love with him because he was so like his sire. And those of us who have become fathers in our own life, you know, you may recollect what we feel about our own child. This is the most wonderful thing in the world. And then we make the mistake of saying there is no other thing like it. You see? And so forth. Well, now, they have presented that. But actually, when this wonderful thing, the child, which is God embodied there in front of you, has grown up, he projects God out of his image, out of himself. God is like this, that, and the other. I drink 5 bottles of whiskey a day, God drinks 50 bottles of whiskey a day. You see, because everything has to be superlative with God, and so forth. This is the great error which manifestation makes. It tries to present transcendence in its own image. But with the right sort of attentiveness, this open-minded, free attentiveness, then all these limitations imposed upon us disappear gradually. And you come to know this perishable self, this psychophysical self. You come to know your body, your thoughts, your feelings, your actions, and so forth. And that is the beginning point. When you really know that, you have realized perfect egohood. This is the first root harmony which we have to achieve. In this context, I can use the word achieve and attain. This is what we as particular psychophysical organisms can achieve, can attain. And it is a necessary achievement and attainment. Then comes the further procedure where the individuality which we have realized in the particular, that is to say one's own psychophysical being, has to grow into the supreme individuality, which means that in consciousness, in mind and consciousness, you realize the complete harmony of this particular being, oneself, with the totality, which is the cosmos. Then there is no separation anywhere. And when that separation has disappeared, when that isolativeness of consciousness has disappeared, then there is holiness manifest perfectly through the particular self, your own psychophysical being. You are the Holy One then. And under those conditions, you don't fear death. You see that what is commonly called life and death, they are in fact an identity. We think of life as that which grows and grows and grows. The living thing grows and grows and grows. And we think of death as the destruction, the annihilation of the living thing. Now look, supposing you attend completely and fully, you will see that our ordinary understanding of life and death, being born, living 70, 80, 100 years and dying as separate things in the distance. But you will see that that distance will become smaller and smaller and smaller until you will see the simultaneity of life and death. I say simultaneity for this reason. When we talk of the body growing, for instance, you see, what does growing mean? It means that it has changed from the previous position, from the previous condition. Any growth is a change of the previous condition. Now, if you can follow that change at the same rate as that at which the total universal process goes on, you will see that the change takes place in an infinitesimal fraction of time. Now, if attentiveness can be so developed that it can take that tremendous life-death rhythm, as it is called, I call it the life, other life pulse. It's the creative pulse, the life, other life pulse. If you can take that in, where is death? Death is faded out of your consciousness. And all the fear and anxiety and foolish thoughts and ideas and philosophies developed about afterlife and so forth, all that just disappears. You may say, it is not death which is faded out, it is life which is faded out. Not so. Because that which was is now. And the process is a process of the was becoming is now. And in that process, it is life, other life, which is the reality, not life, death. Is this too difficult, or you can follow it? Good. So then, when you really see that, and you are fully conscious of it, you are actually experiencing here and now, in your living lifetime here in the body, you are experiencing the meaning of immortality, not mortality. Otherwise, we experience our whole life in the mode of mortality. For us, everything begins, proceeds, comes to an end. Life, death, life, death. You see, look, the beginning was your coming to this room, coming to this house. Now, the proceeding is our meeting here. And the dying, the ending, the dying, will be when you go out. But if your attentiveness is total and complete, you will not see it that way. You will see it in terms of the infinite and the eternal. You will be conscious of it that way. Of course, you have only my word for it. But take it for what it is worth or not worth, as the case may be. You please yourself. That is your responsibility. I'd like to read to you something which I have recently written on this very point. When one is conscious in those terms, one has freed oneself from consciousness functioning in terms of the temporal, the mortal, and the finite. Then there is a fusion in consciousness with the conscious, with the transcendent consciousness, which is infinite, eternal, immortal. The fusion in consciousness is the realization, the making real of immortality. Now, the perfected Holy One can enter into that consciousness again and again, as and when he wants to, as and when he needs to. Now this is contradicted by Christian mysticism and other mysticisms too, but it is most categorically affirmed by the mystics of India and the Far East generally as such. So when this earthly life ends, the complete and perfect death of this existential being, because there is the death in the sense that the transformation of the manifested being is so complete and perfect that it no longer exists as that particular identifiable entity. It is this identifiable entity which disappears altogether. The complete and perfect death of this existential being spells the release of the embodied transcendence out of its self-imposed constriction. Remember, a little while earlier on I said that transcendence by self-constriction becomes the manifested universe. It is as if that which is pure energy materializes itself. No finite mortal liberates himself. He can only liberate the embodied transcendence by his flowering into the full-fledged, perfect human. Every flower, the existential shape and form, soon withers and dies. Its perfume gladdens man and the world and lives deathlessly as a happy memory. Never crave, then, for your separate personal perpetuity, a tragic trapping in time's tormenting tentacles. Do not fear death of the body, but, like the sere leaf ready to dance its ecstatic return into the bosom of Mother Earth, silently and peacefully greet that supremely divine moment when the infinite eternal will bless you for your perfect selfless service towards effecting its own release out of the bonds of existence. Thou art immortal. Thou art Ahmi, the eternal I am. Sing, O heavenly bird, sing praise to the Lord of life and wisdom for sending sweet death to heal all my ill and open the door to his own immortality. Not my immortality. No such thing as my immortality.